From the studios of NPR West, this is Day to Day. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen. Coming up, the first of the Guantanamo war crime trials is underway today. We'll hear from Slate's legal expert, Dahlia Lithwick.
First, Barack in Baghdad. The Democratic presidential nominee met with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki and senior U.S. officials. Sudarshan Raghavan is the Baghdad bureau chief for The Washington Post. Sudarshan, I know you are not actually with Senator Obama, but do you have a sense of what's on his agenda and who he is meeting with now that he's finally there?
Sure. We actually did meet up with Senator Obama when he was visiting with Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki, as well as senior Iraqi officials, including the National Security Advisor Muwaffaq Rabai, as well as the government spokesperson and other officials. Along with them was Ambassador Ryan Crocker, as well as the Deputy Secretary of State for Iraq, David Satterfield. So from what we've heard so far, it was an amicable meeting, and there was no discussions of troop withdrawals, according to the Iraqis, because they discussed true withdrawals only with administration in power. But overall, it seemed to be the meeting seemed to have gone pretty well.
Are there any statements to come out of this trip? And what is it that Senator Obama is doing with the rest of his time there?
Well, there have been no official statements yet. We certainly tried to press Senator Obama when he walked out of the meeting with Maliki, but he basically turned our questions away, saying that he would provide more details of his trip later on. So nothing substantive yet. After the meeting with Prime Minister Maliki, he went to meet President Talabani, and after that, from what we understand, he'll be meeting with General Petraeus later on this evening. But so far, nothing concrete from the Obama camp.
I don't know if he'll have any chance to actually meet with American servicemen and servicewomen while he's there.
That's still unclear. I mean, it's quite possible. You know, he is spending time, quite a bit of time in the green zone, you know, where there are quite a number of American troops. From what we understand, you know, he is planning to spend the night, so that there is a possibility that he might actually meet with some troops. But, of course, everything is being really kept quiet because of security concerns.
And what about the statement over the weekend from Mr. Maliki to a German magazine that he thought Senator Obama's projected timeline for getting out of Iraq, that is 16 months, that he thought that was about right? How is that playing there? Any response from especially senior U.S. officials?
They're pointing out that the Iraqi government actually put out a statement saying that those comments were actually misinterpreted. Prime Minister Maliki was in no way endorsing Senator Obama's proposal. And it certainly seems that the Iraqi government are backtracking from those comments. They, you know, there's a sense today, certainly I felt, that you know, they were trying very hard not to inject themselves into American politics. And they made it very clear that their meetings with Senator Obama was not as a as any head of state, but it was more of a cordial meeting to improve relations between the Iraq and the United States. Now, having said that, Senator Obama, in fact, did get pretty much of a red carpet welcome by the Iraqis. You know, he was met by senior officials, and even when he was sitting with Prime Minister Maliki, it was very much clear his importance to the Iraqis.
Washington Post Baghdad Bureau Chief Sudarshan Raghavan. Sudarshan, thank you.
My pleasure.
For more on this story now, I'm joined by NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Ron, welcome back to the program. And the Iraqis have said after Der Spiegel, the German magazine, released these comments over the weekend that Mr. Maliki's words were misinterpreted, though I'll note it was an official Iraqi government translation of them. Where do we stand on this?
Al-Maliki's in a very tough spot here, Alex. He does not want to embarrass the Bush administration. He doesn't want to bite the hand that feeds him. But at the same time, for his own domestic politics, he needs this timeline and he needs to speak well of it whenever it comes up, as in the Der Spiegel interview last week. So he needs to be able to tell his own folks the Americans will be leaving sooner rather than later. And he doesn't want to endorse a candidate for president in the United States. He doesn't want to endorse Barack Obama. But he does need to endorse the idea of 2010 as the year the U.S. gets out.
What about risks in all this for Senator Obama, the appearance perhaps of compromising official U.S. negotiations with Mr. Maliki's government?
Yes, that is a huge risk. Anytime any American candidate starts to speak to people in foreign countries, that he may appear to be undercutting official U.S. diplomacy. And Senator Obama has tried to be somewhat careful about that. He says, well, you know, there's only one U.S. president at a time. But let's stop and think about why he's over there in the first place. He was challenged to go over there. He was taunted about his lack of face time with world leaders and with the generals in Iraq. So that's why he's on the trip in the first place. You can't say, why don't you go talk to the Iraqis and the generals, and then say you're shocked to see him over there shaking hands with the Iraqis and the generals.
Well, here's what Senator McCain said today. This is on CBS's early show this morning about Senator Obama's visit.
There's very little doubt in my mind that he will see for himself that he had a gross misjudgment, and then he'll correct that.
He's speaking about the success of the surge, the increased U.S. military presence in Iraq. We actually haven't heard much at all from Senator Obama so far coming out of this Baghdad trip.
That's right. He's still in the fact-gathering stage of this. He's been a little time in Afghanistan, a little time in Iraq, and we'll doubtless hear more when he gets together with the entourage of reporters who are meeting him in Amman, Jordan. But, you know, John McCain at this point really wants the argument about Iraq to be about the success of the surge, because he was all for it. He was one of the people who pushed it, and Barack Obama didn't believe in it, didn't think we should do it. So John McCain really wants to talk about how well the surge has worked, just as Barack Obama for years has been wanting to talk about the original decision to go into Iraq in the first place. So those are the past things. The future thing now is going to be, when and how does the U.S. get out?
Well, that's the question. And a big development on Friday, I think anyway, that is the Bush administration embracing, or at least acknowledging, the idea of a general time horizon for drawing down U.S. forces in Iraq. What does time horizon mean, and what is this? What does time horizon mean, and is this indeed a big deal?
Secretary of State Rice referred to this as an aspirational goal. In other words, it's something to aspire to, a time horizon, not a timeline. And the official White House position is still that they're against anything specific in the way of a timeline, and they want victory. That's the John McCain position. But suddenly John McCain hears the White House also talking this other language about time horizons and aspirational goals to get the U.S. troops out, and that leaves him out on a limb a little bit, because he hasn't pivoted quite so quickly from his rather more indefinite period of commitment for U.S. troops in Iraq.
You know, Ron, we said on this program last week in Conversations that Senator Obama was taking a whole bunch of reporters with him on this trip. In fact, you've just pointed out an important distinction. He's meeting them in Jordan after his stops in Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yes, he went over to Afghanistan with just two reporters in tow, and they were both print reporters from AP, the Associated Press, and from Barack Obama's hometown newspaper, the Chicago Tribune, and they were sending back pool reports. And then there were some photographs taken while he was there, but they were taken by people who were on the ground. They were not taken by entourage people traveling with Barack Obama. He's going to do a fair amount of that when he gets to Europe and some of the other Middle Eastern countries, but they kept it to a minimum while he was in the war zones.
NPR Senior Washington Editor Ron Elving. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
Today, the first U.S. war crimes trial since World War II begins at the Guantanamo Bay Naval Base in Cuba. The trial will determine the fate of Salim Hamdan, a former driver for Osama bin Laden. It will also be a test of the military legal system at Guantanamo. Joining us now to tell us more about the case is Slate.com's legal expert, Dahlia Lithwick. Dahlia, thanks for joining us. And can you remind us what exactly Salim Hamdan is accused of?
Sure, Alex. He is the 37-year-old Yemeni who is allegedly Osama bin Laden's driver, for which he, I gather, earned $200 a month. He's also allegedly bin Laden's former bodyguard, and he's been charged with providing material support for terrorism in his actions as driver, bodyguard, allegedly as a weapons courier for bin Laden. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who really was the mastermind of 9/11, has said that one of the things that Hamdan did was drove the women and children away from danger in his role as bodyguard. So the charge is this sort of vague, providing material aid to the enemy.
He's been at Guantanamo for quite some time. Why has it taken so long for him to get to trial?
Well, Alex, because the government invented this whole new military tribunal system with which to try the terrorists. We haven't used military tribunals since World War II, so they're a little bit rusty. And to say that the system of tribunals that has been set up for years and years progresses in fits and starts is to overstate it, because it's been all fits and no starts so far. The system has been struck down completely by the Supreme Court in 2006 in a case actually that has Hamdan's name on it. The whole system was then resuscitated later that year by the Congress. But after all these years, there's only been one conviction through the system, and that was through a plea bargain. It was of David Hicks, the Australian Taliban, the kangaroo trapper, who served less than a year sentence in Australia and is now free. So the system's been kind of a mess, and every time they fix it, arguably they make it worse.
And how will this trial differ from a regular civilian trial?
Well, for one thing, today the jury pool is being assembled, and it's comprised of 13 people, all of whom are military officers. But just in general, in addition to it being run by the military and prosecuted by the military and judged by the military, there's also an issue of just enormous deference to the prosecution and the prosecution side of the story, and rules of evidence that are much, much, much more generous than you'd ever see in a civilian trial. For instance, hearsay evidence is allowed into this trial against Hamdan, and even evidence obtained by means of, quote, cruel and, quote, inhuman interrogations will be admissible. So much, much, much harder fight for Hamdan than he would be finding in a criminal trial.
Earlier today, he pled not guilty. Even if he is acquitted, he likely won't be released. What will happen to him?
Well, this is because the Bush administration can still call him an enemy combatant, even if he's innocent of the charges, the specific charges of which he's been accused. And in fact, only a handful of the people at Guantanamo who are called enemy combatants are even going to face these military trials. So the vast majority of them will just be held there, presumably, says the administration, until the end of hostilities. Now, there's an even more interesting question, which is everybody is telegraphing that they want to close Guantanamo, which raises the possibility that we're going to hold Hamdan and everyone else at Guantanamo till the end of hostilities, whenever that may be, but not at Guantanamo. It's going to be very difficult to send him back to Yemen. The administration says they don't feel reassured that even if he's acquitted, that the Yemenis can keep us safe from him again. And so a real question is whether he's then going to be held for the rest of his life, whether or not he's found innocent or guilty.
Dahlia Lithwick, legal expert for Slate.com and for Day to Day, thank you.
It's always a pleasure, Alex.
This is Day to Day. I'm Alex Cohen.
I'm Alex Chadwick. When we talk about the least developed places in the world, we kind of think about Afghanistan or maybe Bangladesh. You don't think about that term, least developed, applied here in the U.S.
But a new study called Measure of America looks at social development within this country. New York's Upper East Side is the most developed, no surprise there. But the result for the least developed region is a bit more unexpected. It's not Appalachia. It's not the Mississippi Delta. It's California's Central Valley. As part of our California Dreaming series, Philip Martin reports.
Life for farm worker Felipe Jesus Perez illustrates why Fresno County, California is at the bottom of the American Human Development Index.
I'm worried that I have 3 kids, my wife, and I don't have a job. We don't find any kind of job for my wife. She's doing some application and different kind of job, and nobody called her.
When he was 19 and living in Mexico, Perez says he dreamed of coming to California. Now at age 39 and a legal resident, he's still ecstatic about the Golden State, but his current dream is simply to have a job in an area where seasonally adjusted unemployment stands at a shocking 30%.
This affects my life because, you know, the people that live around here, they live by farming. They are losing their jobs because of the water.
Massive drought is the latest calamity to hit California's Central Valley, in what over the past 10 years has been a confluence of misery, beginning in 1999 with flooding, and then the mortgage crisis and gas crisis. Jose Antonio Ramirez is city manager for the town of Fireball. That's its real name. And on this day, it's 108 degrees. We're driving along a road lined with corn stalks that stand stoic like soldiers until you take a closer look.
Right now, what you have is you have farms that are being fallowed because they're not receiving the sufficient supply of water. Those plants shrivel and die. And what is that doing to our community? Well, you have hundreds of people that are being let go. And so it's a domino effect that's going to really hurt us bad. And uh, we're We're actually scared.
Ramirez, who came to the U.S. from Mexico as a child, is the son of farm workers. Almost everyone around here is. He hands me a peach as an example of the kinds of crops his 60-year-old mother picks on an almost daily basis.
That peach that I just gave you there, she gave him to me yesterday. And she's working in this 108-degree weather.
People here die young. In fact, on average, they live 4.5 years fewer on this earth than residents of Manhattan's Upper East Side. Fresno itself, California's sixth largest city, is dealing with another set of problems that complicates its development. On one side of downtown, a new ultra-modern city hall, a Starbucks, and a well-groomed park. Across these railroad tracks is an actual shanty town, tarps over cardboard, scraps of metal here and there covered by plastic. It looks like a scene out of Soweto, which seems to grow larger by the month, says Ramirez, who sits on a municipal homelessness advisory committee. He stops the car to speak with a man who calls himself E, who complains that the city has not kept its promises to the poor.
They've been allocating money for the homeless for years, and they ain't been doing nothing for the homeless, you know.
How long have you yourself been without a home?
I'm not really homeless in heart, you see what I'm saying? Because I choose to be out here with these people. You have to stand up for something and be counted for something. These people are my people. This is West Fresno. This is where I was raised and born.
But almost everyone else in this county was born way outside of the sprawling area, west of the Sierra Nevada and south of Sacramento. More than 80 ethnic communities call Fresno home. They include residents from Mexico, India, Armenia, and Southeast Asia. Last year, these groups helped elect to the Fresno City Council a man named Blong Jung, who was born on a Thai refugee camp. He's now council president. Jung ponders the irony that his adopted city is listed dead last on the development scale often used to measure societies like the one from which he came.
We speak over 87 different languages, and it's usually these communities that end up into the lower echelon because they're transitioning, and they end up living in areas of poverty, and that's what they can afford.
Only half of the households in this area have annual incomes above $17,000. The authors of the Human Development Report say that education is key to rising out of poverty. Only 57% of students graduate from high school. An even smaller group, just 6.5%, have graduated from college. And one who did is 36-year-old Jose Antonio Ramirez. In fact, he has a master's degree. He's now working to get his 7 siblings through college.
We're just driving into the home of the Fresno State Bulldogs. This is my alma mater. I call it the rubber band effect. Once you have a taste of Fresno, you leave, but you bounce right back.
We're here to see Ramirez's mentor, Professor Luz Gonzalez, Dean of the School of Social Sciences. She and others are struggling to change the sad statistical reality reflected in the American Human Development Report.
When I was in college here in the 70s, you could count Latinos and African Americans in one hand. And now we're 35% Latino. You know, we're 51% minority. This university is probably the best represented university in terms of diversity, representative of the population of California than any other campus.
Farm worker Felipe Jesus Perez, whom we met earlier, wants his 3 young children to go to Fresno State one day. He doesn't want to see them working these fields, so to encourage them, he takes his kids to Fireball Small Library.
We go over there every week with their kids. Tuesday and Thursday, we went to the library.
Felipe is limping through the community garden. His foot was crushed in a cotton thrasher 6 years ago. He raises his cane and smiles, pointing to the crops he's growing for his family.
This is corn. This is pea, watermelon.
Felipe says he and his wife, Araceli, are growing fresh fruits and vegetables on a patch of arid earth where some said crops could never grow given the water crisis. Perhaps a fitting metaphor for the effort by many in Fresno County to make this a land of plenty for themselves. Despite drought and unemployment, Felipe and his neighbors say this is still their California dream. For NPR News, I'm Philip Martin.
For more on the people and places in Philip Martin's piece, visit Daydreaming. It's Day to Day's official blog. You can find it at www.npr.org/daydreaming. Thank you. here in California, scattered showers forecast for later today likely won't be enough to put out some of the more than 30 wildfires still burning. That means more work for firefighters and bigger bills for the state. The current cost of firefighting in California is expected to reach more than $1 billion. That's twice what the state spent a decade ago. From member station KQED in San Francisco, Amy Standen reports.
It doesn't look like much today, but 17 years ago, this scrubby Berkeley hillside overlooking Highway 24 was on every TV screen in the country.
Well, we're basically really close to where the Oakland Hills fire started.
Max Moritz is a fire researcher with UC Berkeley. He says what started as a small grass fire one October weekend in 1991 exploded into a blaze that destroyed more than 3,200 homes and killed 25 people. And yet, says Moritz, there's nothing unusual about these hills.
This is a classic wildland-urban interface situation that, you know, this is a snapshot of what many, many, many communities in California look like.
Moritz says this area, like much of California, is ready to burn again at any time. And when they hit, these fires will threaten more homes and be more expensive to fight than ever. That's because, with California's population growing by 500,000 people a year, development is booming in fire-prone areas like this one. Homes and lives are far more difficult and expensive to protect than wildlands. And that has nearly everyone, including Schwarzenegger, calling for more money.
The firefighters, they're stretched to the limit. And I think the key thing for us is to create more resources as quickly as possible.
The federal government picks up much of California's firefighting tab, and as fire season lengthens, particularly in California, the costs grow, up 41% just since last year. Nationwide, in fact, the cost of fighting fires has grown from 13% of the Federal Forest Department's budget in 1991 to almost half of it projected for 2009. Much of that cash heads to California to reimburse CAL FIRE, the largest state firefighting agency in the country. But Schwarzenegger says the state needs to raise even more money. He wants all Californians to contribute to a new firefighting fund. And no one's more enthusiastic about that idea than CAL FIRE, whose director is Ruben Grijalva.
It will bring to us 11 helicopters that will be 24-hour all-risk helicopters. They will have night flying capability, which we currently don't have. They'll have a heavier payload capacity.
But those who live in cities will see none of this new gear. That's because those helicopters will go where the fires are, rural areas where new developments abut wildlands. And therein lies the dilemma facing legislators. Why should all Californians pay for a service that only some of them will use? At least that's Christine Kehoe's problem with the Schwarzenegger bill. The Democratic state senator from San Diego wants rural dwellers to pay more for firefighting. She's proposing a $50 tax on homeowners in fire-prone areas.
Californians that choose to live in high fire hazard severity zones need to pay their fair share of the tremendous costs that go into firefighting. That's the fair way to handle it.
To single out a small group and say, we're going to penalize you because of where you live, and that's just absurd.
Kevin Jeffries is a former firefighter and a Republican state assemblyman who represents some of the fire-prone areas that Kehoe's bill would affect.
I mean, let's go to L.A. County and say, look, you're sending too many prisoners to our state prison, so we're going to tax everybody who lives in L.A. County because you're filling up our prisons. And that's just ridiculous. We're all in this together.
But Jeffries says he speaks for many other Republicans as well, whose real objection is that the state would impose any new taxes at all.
We're going to have a state budget close to $110 billion. For the state of California to tell the taxpayers we don't have enough money to fund our police and firefighters is absurd. It's a matter of priorities.
Meanwhile, hunkered down under the smoky skies of Sacramento, state lawmakers are still haggling over just those priorities. That's because this year's fire season coincides with yet another explosive state phenomenon, a multi-billion dollar budget deficit and endless negotiations to come up with compromises to fund all the state's needs. For NPR News, I'm Amy Standen in San Francisco.
From NPR News, it's Day to Day. Last weekend was a big one at the movies, the biggest ever, in fact, topping $250 million. And that's thanks in large part to the latest Batman movie, The Dark Knight. Until now, last year's Spider-Man 3 held the record for the biggest opening numbers. Joining us now is Marketplace's John Dimsdale. John, the film industry's been in a bit of a slump, so how good is this news?
Well, you're right. Overall, this year, theater attendance is off about 4%. And that's due in part to changes in the way that films are distributed. More and more people are getting their movie fix on their computers or their cell phones. Or they have these great entertainment systems at home and they just wait for the DVD. But this weekend's record box office shows that summer is still a great time to issue a blockbuster. People are on vacation, kids are out of school, you can get families into the theaters all during the week. And Amir Mallon, an entertainment industry analyst with Qualia Capital, says this is all good for Hollywood because the audience probably saw three or four previews for upcoming films, and it reminded people what they like about going to the movies.
I went to see the film this weekend, and there was a lot of applause at the end. So it kind of validates the theatrical experience, and that's always good for the business. Especially coming now, it's evidence that the theatrical experience and the film business in general is really recession-proof.
John, I have not seen this movie yet, so don't give anything away. But can you tell me how exactly this Batman movie pulled off this record-breaking draw?
Well, of course, Batman is a hugely popular franchise to begin with, and the film did get very good advance reviews. It was shown in 4,000 movie theaters over the weekend. There's an IMAX draw. It was shown on these huge screens at almost 100 IMAX theaters. And then there was the curiosity about Heath Ledger's performance. He died 6 months ago after finishing his role as the Joker in the movie, and Amir Mallon thinks Ledger was a very big draw.
I'm an Academy voter, and I would be very, very surprised if he didn't get a posthumous nomination. And relative to the other performances that we'll probably see through the end of the year, wouldn't be surprising if he wins Best Supporting Actor nomination as well.
Dark Knight was a Warner Brothers film, so what does all of this mean for the studio that produced it?
Well, Warner had been, they had a great spring with Sex and the City, but its summer movies, Speed Racer and Get Smart, have only been modest successes. So this weekend should pull Warner out of a summertime slump. You could say The Dark Knight has become a white knight for Warner. And by the way, Warner's looking forward to another big blockbuster this fall. Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince is due out in November.
That I will be seeing opening weekend. Thank you so much, John. That's John Dimsdale of Public Radio's daily business show, Marketplace.
It's Day to Day from NPR News. I'm Alex Chadwick.
And I'm Alex Cohen. This week, the House and Senate wrangle over proposals aimed at bringing down the cost of gas. But neither measure is expected to change the price at the pump anytime soon. So today, we're looking at a couple of ways to avoid your car. In a few minutes, we'll hear about the best cities to walk in. First, though, Celeste Headley reports on new calls to rebuild the public transit system in the hometown of the U.S. auto industry.
Years ago, Detroit had one of the largest streetcar systems in the U.S. You could hop on a sleek electric car and travel quickly out of the city to your home in the suburbs.
When I was a little boy on a Sunday, my parents took me to ride the Detroit streetcar. And I said, why are we riding this on Sunday? Because at that time, businesses were closed on Sunday. They said, we're riding it because it's the last day that this streetcar is going to run. That was 1956.
John Hertel is now the CEO of the Detroit Regional Mass Transit Authority. Those cars were sent to Mexico City, perhaps because they seemed old-fashioned in the post-World War II boom when everyone wanted their own set of wheels. The Detroit area hasn't had any comprehensive public transportation since that last streetcar went south. But Megan Owens of the nonprofit group Transportation Riders United says the region has had other opportunities to build mass transit.
In the 1970s, the federal government offered the Detroit area $600 million if we could just come up with a plan to build public transit. And the city and the suburbs couldn't agree.
It was an opportunity knocking on the door, and nobody opened it.
Brooks Patterson is the executive of Oakland County that borders Detroit to the north. At the time the government offered that $600 million, the region was still smarting from the aftershocks of the Detroit riots, and Coleman Young was the defiant mayor of the city. Many people say it was racism that kept the region from reaching agreement on a plan to link the largely black Detroit to the mostly white suburbs. Patterson was a law student at the time.
Nobody called me and asked me if I wanted to have mass transit, so I don't think you can blame it on the general population. It's the leadership that failed us at that time.
Since then, there have been 23 serious efforts to install transit lines in Metro Detroit. They've all failed, except a proposal to create bus lines in the suburbs. And Patterson says that's because not enough people use public transportation. A Grand Trunk rail line used to stretch for 31 miles from Pontiac to Detroit. It was dismantled in the late 80s because ridership fell below 500.
Now, what has changed in the minds of the public that if we go out and build a multi-billion dollar line requiring millions of dollars in subsidies to maintain, why must you think we're going to get 500 people or more that we couldn't even get when Detroit had a larger center in downtown with more jobs and more people?
John Hertel says a lot has changed. Gas prices are high, people are concerned about pollution, and business leaders now recognize the economic value of mass transit. He says cities like Dallas, Portland, and Denver have seen huge benefits from investments in public transportation.
In all those places, for every dollar they put into mass transit, there's been an investment by the private sector of, on average, over $7, 7 to 1.
Business leaders in Metro Detroit are now jumping on board the mass transit wagon. Matt Cullen is the CEO of Rock Enterprises, the holding company for Quicken Loans. He says the chairman of his company, Dan Gilbert, has been working hard to get some kind of mass transit plan approved.
It's not altruism. He really believes that in order to be competitive, in order to attract the best and brightest young folks coming out of college and so on, you need to have the environment that they're going to find appealing.
And that environment, Cullen says, is a strong inner city with good public transportation, not a bunch of parking lots. Brooks Patterson says mass transit is a wonderful thing, but he doesn't think Michigan can afford it right now.
We're considered the fourth wealthiest county in America. We just let 152 of my best and brightest go early because we had to reduce our budget to offset the shortfall. So these are tough times, and is mass transit a priority? We'll see.
Megan Owen says politicians still remember the riots of the 70s and were involved in the often rancorous bickering that's plagued Detroit and its suburbs for 50 years.
There was some discussion of, is it just a waiting game till some of this older generation that are stuck in that 60s and 70s mindset are retiring and moving on?
Still, a bill to fund public transportation using property tax revenues is making its way through the Michigan House right now. And after 5 decades of letting opportunities knock go unanswered, leaders in Detroit hope this time someone opens the door. Celeste Headley, NPR News, Detroit.
If you can't take the subway or bus, try walking. Easier in some places than others, of course. A study by a Seattle software firm ranks America's most walkable neighborhoods. San Francisco, New York, and Boston lead the top 10. Los Angeles is number 9, right above Portland, Oregon. Chris Leinberger is a land use strategist who advised on the study. Walkability, a new term for me, is a simple concept, he says.
It's where you can get your daily needs met within walking distance. And walking distance is generally considered to be about a half mile, 3,000 feet. And if you live within that kind of a district, you will probably be using your feet a whole lot more than you're using your car.
And what is it that makes that district walkable? What's there?
You'll find at least a grocery store that can service you on a daily basis, say hardware store, drug store, restaurants. Maybe your kids can walk to school. And in the best of all possible worlds, you can walk to work.
So this walkability index, how long has that been around? How long have people been studying that?
Well, we've been studying it for many, many years, but it's only been the last 15 years that there's been market demand.
You know, on this list of the most walkable cities, I find San Francisco at the top. But if you walk around San Francisco, boy, that's a very hilly place, isn't it?
This walk score does not take that into account. there are still issues that need to be addressed to refine this system. So, you know, it doesn't take into account the fact that on a summer day in Phoenix, most people wouldn't want to be walking outside.
Right.
And the same goes for bodies of water. Same goes for highways that may, you know, freeways that may be stopping you from walking a very short distance, but you can't get from here to there because of a freeway.
Something on this list puzzles me. Los Angeles is more walkable than Portland, Oregon. Portland is famous for its high self-regard about people's ability to get around that city in a humane way.
Well, Los Angeles is, believe it or not, one of the most dense cities in the country. While it's not been planned to be walkable, there are historical relics of walkability in the city of Los Angeles. And the development over the last 10 years has increased its walkability. And finally, what you've done in Southern California in general, but Los Angeles in particular, is that you are beginning to put back in your rail transit system.
Chris, you're a land use strategist. You consult with developers. You've worked as a developer in your past. How is the price of gas changing the way developers are thinking and maybe boosting this walkability idea?
It is accelerating a underlying market trend. My research shows, others' research shows, that anywhere from 30 to 50% of households want to live in a walkable urban place. In most metropolitan areas, it's no more than 5 or 10% supply, so you've got this high demand and low supply, and prices go out of sight, which is what we've seen throughout the country, and great concern about gentrification.
Chris Lineberger, he's a land use strategist currently at the Brookings Institution. His book on urban development, The Option of Urbanism, was published this year. Chris Lineberger, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Back now with Day to Day and good news. Our humorist Brian Unger is back too. Here's today's Unger Report.
I think we're sending the wrong signals to the oil companies, to the CEOs, the sheikhs, the politicians, well, to the evil despotic overlords of our world's oil supply. Our feedback is flawed. Put yourself in their shoes or sandals or their bejeweled footwear. How upset do we really appear to, say, the Saudis, when we're willing to sleep without shelter, outside, on a cold, urine-soaked New York City sidewalk for 8 days, waiting to buy a cell phone?
We are working on a project to set a new Guinness Book of World Records for the longest time waiting in line to buy something.
This is not a good project for young people. The Peace Corps, Meals on Wheels, these are projects. Buying something, I don't recall JFK writing about that in Profiles in Courage. Oh yes, we are mad. Apple earned about $330 million during the first weekend of iPhone 3G sales, according to Fortune. What does this mean? It means we're so angry about gas prices and the economy, we're determined to email someone about it. Twice as fast with awesome applications. Now I can play Super Monkey Ball while I sit in traffic. That's where we're really thumbing our noses at those oil speculators and cartels. We're taking to the streets in millions of cars, in the same choking, unabated morass of traffic to tell OPEC, we're not going to tolerate these high gas prices anymore. In fact, if I ever get to where I'm going, I'm going to call someone to complain about it from my iPhone. But to send a clear signal to the leadership of this country, well, just pretend for a moment we have leaders who stand up to the corporate interests who profit from the high price of gas. We all went to see Batman. Here's a guy in line this weekend.
Batman shows us that if we push the human mind to its maximum, we can achieve something like that.
If we put our minds to it, we'll all be flying like bats. Achieving energy independence, I don't know, that's pure fantasy to me. We did achieve something historic. A record box office weekend, over $155 million. We deserve to imagine ourselves as bats. We deserve the best cell phones, too. But somewhere, I hear a Saudi prince laughing as he slaps an oil executive on the back as a politician carries their water. And I wonder, who's the real joker? And that is today's Unger Report. I'm Brian Unger.
And remember, you can take your Unger with you. Humor from the Unger Report is available as an NPR podcast. Find out more at npr.org.
And finally, today it's July. It's hot in a lot of places. Staying cool is the new what for everyone. We are going to what may be the busiest and most popular clothing-optional beach in the entire country. It's Gunnison Beach in Sandy Hook, New Jersey. NPR's Margot Adler found the sunbathers there, protective of their little piece of paradise and their privacy. Still, there was one couple willing to share.
Anyone who's ever gone skinny dipping knows there's a certain freedom to taking off your clothes and running into the water. Dale D'Estasio, the president of Friends of Gunnison Beach, has been coming here for more than 30 years. Remember when you were a kid, she says, and you were about to leave the beach and your mom...
She would put the towel around you and you had to drop your swimsuit and then she'd make you rinse off. Well, a lot of kids would escape that towel and go running around the beach naked, and they remember that. They remember that freedom.
There have been nude bathers here, she says, even when it was a military base. The soldiers, all men, would take a nude dip. The base was decommissioned in 1972 and officially opened as a clothing optional beach in the mid-1970s. At that time, a big crowd might be 20 people. Bob Gestel is known fondly as the mayor of Gunnison Beach because he's been coming here since the beginning.
It's grown and grown and grown.
Is it too big yet?
Yes.
He now only comes on weekdays. Recently, Manhattanites have been able to take the Sea Streak ferry to the beach, no pun intended, a fast, traffic-free, lovely ride. But at $43 round trip, it's expensive. Most people drive. As you watch the people on the beach, you see every race. You see almost every age, although most people seem over 50. You see a few smokers. You see people reading, people sunbathing, and there's volleyball.
It's out.
Yeah.
21, 16,
17. About half the people are nude, a quarter are topless, and the rest are wearing bathing suits, shorts, and beach wraps. But the thing that strikes one most is how easy it is to strike up a conversation. Dale D'Estasio.
When you're not wearing clothes, you have nothing to show everybody else how much you make and what you do for a living. You know, the Nike sneakers are gone, the $300 earrings got left at home. And it's a tremendous equalizer.
But if they're willing to strike up a conversation, they don't want to be interviewed by the media, and they certainly don't want to give their names.
People think that if you take your clothes off, then there's got to be sex involved. Publicity brings a lot of gawkers, people that want to come down here and make my lifestyle their source of entertainment for the day.
And every once in a while, a lifeguard or park ranger has to throw someone off the beach for acting inappropriately. Mayor Bob advises them.
Get a room. You know, you can't do it here.
Years ago, we didn't have a park ranger of our own, and we didn't have lifeguards. And we used to have to police the beach ourselves. And we would tell people, get a room, if they were being inappropriate.
Taking pictures without permission, for example, is a no-no. If gawkers understood, they said, that the average nudist could be a member of AARP, they might stay home.
I think that you let a lot go once you hit a certain age. You don't care what people think of you.
Nobody's going to say, oh, you got a bad body, you know, whatever. Everybody's got a different body.
And eventually you don't care.
Many of the people on this beach have come here for decades. The one group you don't see here are teens. D'Estasio says that's just human nature.
Because they're developing and everything is gross and you don't want to see mom and dad naked. And then somewhere in their late 20s, early 30s, they come back. And their kids stay until they're 12.
And it's true. My 17-year-old said, you go, Mom. Margot Adler, NPR News.
Margot, you're looking very good. Day to Day is a production of NPR News with contributions from Slate.com. I'm Alex Chadwick.
I'm Alex Cohen.